If asking your mate down the pub about vaping, here's what they'd probably say. No one agrees if it's safer or not, so you might as well smoke anyway. Now what your mate needs is a Cochrane review. All the facts have been checked at least twice. They'd find there's a lot that the experts agree on and might give you different advice.
Hi, my name is Nicola and I'm a researcher based at the University of Oxford in the UK.
And I'm Jamie and I'm a researcher based at the University of Massachusetts Amherst in the United States.
We are both members of the Cochrane Tobacco Addiction Group. Welcome to this edition of Let's Talk E-Cigarettes. This podcast is a companion to a research project being carried out at the University of Oxford, where every month we research the e-cigarette research literature to find new studies. We then use these studies to update our Cochrane systematic reviews of e-cigarettes for smoking cessation and interventions for quitting vaping. This type of review is called a living systematic review, and in each episode we start by going through the studies we found that month and then go into more detail about a particular study or topic related to e-cigarettes.
So this month we ran our searches on the 1st of October. For our review of e-cigarettes for quitting smoking, we found one new study and two new ongoing studies. For a review of interventions for quitting vaping, we found one new ongoing study. I'll start by telling you about that one new study of e-cigarettes for quitting smoking in a nutshell. The new study is an abstract presented by Professor Jonathan Folds from Penn State University at the World Conference on Tobacco Control. In his study, 80 people who smoked and were living with psychiatric disorders were randomized to one of four potential study arms. This study tested both e-cigarettes and very low nicotine cigarettes. So the four study arms were normal nicotine cigarettes and high nicotine e-cigarettes. The second study arm was normal nicotine cigarettes and zero nicotine e-cigarettes. The third study arm was very low nicotine cigarettes and high nicotine e-cigarettes. And the fourth study arm was very low nicotine cigarettes and zero nicotine e-cigarettes. The study team measured smoking status, serious adverse events, non-serious adverse events, and biomarkers including NNAL and exhaled carbon monoxide. They reported that at week 16, significantly more of the people who were randomized to receive very low nicotine cigarettes had quit smoking for at least the past week, and that was maintained through to week 20. They didn't find any significant effects of whether or not it was a nicotine or non-nicotine e-cigarette when it came to cigarette consumption. They report that those randomized to very low nicotine cigarettes had fewer serious adverse events than those smoking normal nicotine e-cigarettes, and they conclude that a low nicotine standard for cigarettes might help smokers with psychiatric disorders to reduce and quit smoking without worsening mental health, regardless of access to nicotine e-cigarettes. This study is funded by the National Institutes of Health in the U.S., and we should see a full results paper out in due course. I'll now hand over to Nicola to tell you about the three new ongoing studies.
Thanks, Jamie. First, I'll start with the two new ongoing studies for our review of electronic cigarettes for smoking cessation. So the first of these studies is a study that I'm actually running at the University of Oxford. So it's very exciting that this has now been registered and come through in our searches. We haven't started recruiting participants yet. However, the plan is to look at whether providing people who are accessing financial support services with opportunistic brief advice on quitting smoking, including the offer of nicotine e-cigarettes, increases smoking quit rates. The study is funded by the NIHR in the UK. The second new ongoing study was discovered through a newly published paper of a qualitative interview study that was carried out as part of a large randomized controlled trial. The trial is evaluating the feasibility and acceptability of using e-cigarettes versus NRT in people who smoke receiving outpatient treatment for opioid use disorder. The trial is being carried out by researchers at the New York University, is funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse of the National Institutes of Health, and the main results do not appear to be available yet. The one ongoing study we found for our Interventions for Quitting Vaping review is a protocol for a randomized controlled trial that will test a substance use prevention intervention to specifically target nicotine and cannabis vaping in urban American Indian youth. We've included this at this stage as we believe they may also look at quitting vaping in youth who vape at the start of the study. So we'll keep an eye on that when the study is published. The study appears to be being run out of Arizona State University and is also funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse.
Thanks so much, Nicola. So for this month's deep dive, I had the pleasure of interviewing Justin Strickland, Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Johns Hopkins University in the U.S. We were at a conference together in Burlington, Vermont. It's the Vermont Center on Behavior and Health that runs an annual conference in October for anyone who wants to see some beautiful leaves next to a really beautiful lake and eat really great food and hear very great research. I cannot recommend this particular conference highly enough. But we were sitting outside. It was sunny. We were looking at the lake, so you have to excuse some background noise. I asked Professor Strickland to talk to us about his work on e-cigarette withdrawal, which he presented at the conference, and I'll hand over to him to tell you more about it.
So, can you start off by introducing yourself and telling us how you got into this research space?
Yeah, so I'm Justin Strickland. I'm an associate professor at Johns Hopkins University in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science. So broadly, I'm a behavioral pharmacologist. What that means is I work with substance use and substance use disorder. Most of my work centers on evaluating new medications for substance use. And over sort of the decade or so, a little over a decade of my career, more and more would see comorbidity of tobacco use with other substance use disorders. So I've gotten slowly into the tobacco regulatory space, and in particular, the emergence of e-cigarettes and the use of e-cigarettes amongst the American and international public.
Awesome. Thank you. And you said behavioral pharmacology. I'm also going to ask you to define one other thing, because a lot of this conference is about behavioral economics. And I thought you started your talk with a very good overview of what that means. Can you explain it to us?
Yeah. So a lot of my work centers around behavioral economics, which is a jargonful term. I think people that do behavioral economics research don't necessarily all have the same definition of it. So when I talk about behavioral economics, what I really mean is how the environment, the context we're in, can influence the decisions we make. So that can be things like how the cost of a good impacts our consumption of it. So when something's really cheap, we may love it, but when it gets expensive, we may not. And that differs between different people. So for some people, you're willing to pay more and more and more, versus for some, you're very price sensitive. Another example of that is something we commonly study called delay discounting. So that's the devaluation of a consequence based on its delay. So put simply, we tend to choose things that are much less good now, even if there's something much better around the corner for us. And there's a lot of work that's looked at that in the context of substance use. And actually, in particular, tobacco use. We see this strong association between tobacco use and these sort of behavioral economic features, which makes a lot of sense when we talk about tobacco use. It's the use of something that has this immediate positive effects, but has that long-term risk that we may devalue.
Great. So your presentation today was about e-cigarette withdrawal syndrome. Can you tell us a little bit about what that means and what it looks like for people?
Yeah. So when we talk about the tobacco withdrawal syndrome, broadly, we know a lot from combustible cigarettes. And so that includes things that may involve aversive states, such as drug craving, in that case, cigarette craving. It may involve things like negative mood, so increases in anxiety or increases in just dysphoria or depression-like features. It can involve things like poor sleep or impaired cognition. I mean, we sort of refer to this in the distillate or the aggregate as the tobacco withdrawal syndrome. Some of those symptoms may happen earlier, some may happen later, but they're collectively this withdrawal syndrome. And so when we talk about e-cigarette withdrawal, we don't know as much about e-cigarette withdrawal. They're a relatively newer class of products. There's some reasons to think that it may be different. So when we talk about e-cigarettes, they involve different vehicles or what the e-cigarette delivers the nicotine in. So there's things like propylene glycol, vegetable glycerin, PG or VG, that are not in a cigarette. People also use e-cigarettes in a very different pattern than we've historically thought about with combustibles. With combustibles, you have this sort of pattern where you're using a whole cigarette throughout the day at periodic intervals versus an e-cigarette, you can have this more sort of steady state throughout the day. And collectively, those features may result in a different withdrawal dependence syndrome than with combustibles, but we don't necessarily have the data to speak to that yet.
Great. So you presented interim results from a study you have going on at the moment looking at e-cigarette withdrawal in what I would call a confined setting to start off with. I know that results aren't final, but is there anything so far that you think is important that's come out of this or that surprised you in any way?
Yeah, so this is we've done some preliminary work. We've got an ongoing study where we're looking at people that use e-cigarettes exclusively, so no other tobacco use, minimal other drug use, on our residential unit, so where they stay overnight for 1 week, and measure behavior, measure physiology, measure things like the clearance of nicotine from your body. And so what we've seen so far, again, with the caution of it's ongoing, is that we do see some withdrawal. We see people, for example, see higher levels of craving for their e-cigarette in the first few days after cessation. That then remits or decreases over time. And we also see that those sort of patterns seem to map on into the likelihood of success continuing abstinence after they leave. So, for example, someone who continues to successfully abstain or at least reduce e-cigarette use, there's a decrease in e-cigarette craving throughout that period versus someone who continues to use after they leave that doesn't remit or it stays elevated, which can give us some signals in terms of what we know about tobacco use and cigarette use, that that seems to be the case and it seems to be the similar case here. Some of the top line findings we found so far is we've looked at things like the clearance of nicotine or cotinine, its metabolite, from your system, or propylene glycol, the vehicle I mentioned, and we do see that clearance within the first few days, as well as the clearance of some things that we know as toxicant or carcinogenic markers. So suggesting that you do see a similar clearance as you do with cigarettes, which is a great thing to see. We also see that some of those markers map onto the amount of withdrawal, suggesting that more e-cigarette use does mean more withdrawal or more difficulty quitting, which I think speaks to the success you can have if you take that cessation approach where you have a sort of step down, where you reduce early on and you reduce until you finally are able to abstain. So those are some of the main findings so far. It's an ongoing study. I'm really hoping in the next few years we'll have a lot more findings from it. So be on the lookout for that.
Okay. And one last question for me, and maybe we just don't know yet, but based on everything you know so far, do you think withdrawal symptoms with e-cigarettes are likely to be as bad, worse than, or maybe more mild than cigarettes, knowing that'll vary person to person?
Yeah, so that last part is, I think, actually an excellent point. I think we don't have the amount of people, we don't have the sample yet to speak to that individual variability. I think that's something that's probably critically important. Your history of other tobacco use, biological factors, contextual factors. If I had to conjecture, I don't think it's worse. I don't think we're seeing anything in this initial sample, nor in the literature that's out there, that suggests it's something that's producing a worse dependence in withdrawal syndrome. If anything, perhaps a little milder, but I would caution to go too far to suggest that at this point.
Super. Thank you. And if you had a magic wand and could get research funding to do any one further study in this space, what would it be?
Yeah, so the work that we're doing right now is this sort of short 7-day stay at a residential unit. It's very basic science oriented, so we're interested in characterizing these features. I think what I would love to do is see this propelled into more of a clinical trial space. So you can imagine a much shorter initial residential period where you're going through a monitored withdrawal attempt, and then hopefully then trajectorying people into an 8-week clinical trial, something where you're seeing a long-term success and seeing how those align. So helping people reach hopefully full cessation and seeing for those who don't, what might be predictive of that early on and how can we develop better either medications or behavioral interventions that target that.
Ooh, I would love to see that study. Thank you so much.
Well, Jamie, it sounds like you enjoyed the conference and it's really nice to hear an interview out and about, I think. It made me think that one of the things we've discussed in the context of our newer Interventions for Quitting Vaping review is whether there is a chance people might find it easier to quit vaping than to quit smoking. But there have been reasons why it's difficult for us to draw any conclusions on that with the data we have, as there are issues with just comparing quit rates in our vaping cessation review with the quit rates in some of our reviews around stopping smoking. And that's partly because the statistical methods we use aren't set up that we can directly compare the quit rates between reviews. And also because nicotine vapes are newer products, it could be that people might be finding it easier to quit in this first instance because they might be the people who are most motivated to quit and might find it easier to quit. Whereas with smoking now, we're further down that line, the people who are still smoking might be those people who are most dependent and so will find it harder to quit. So kind of comparing quit rates between the two at one point in time won't necessarily work. Anyway, I feel like this is an incredibly long-winded way of saying that I found it really exciting to have this opportunity to think about the withdrawal effects of nicotine vaping in that bit more detail. And I think studies like this will really improve the information we have available on this topic, which will helpfully give us more of an idea of the mechanisms around quitting vaping and whether it is in fact easier than quitting smoking or harder in fact, or very similar. And I think what's really exciting is that it may in turn feed into the design of new interventions for quitting vaping that could then go on to be eligible for our review in the future. So I just thought that was a nice cycle that you could potentially see happening there.
Oh, lovely. I thought so too. It was really interesting to hear about this. And it's something that I know we've been wondering about as we look at the quit rates come in for our vaping trials compared to the smoking trials that we look at. So we'll keep an eye on this space. We'll let you know if we hear of any exciting updates. And with that being said, thank you so much to Professor Strickland for coming on the podcast, to all of you for listening, and we'll check in again next month.
Please subscribe on iTunes or Spotify and stay tuned for our next episode. Thank you to Jonathan Livingston Banks for running searches, to Elsa Butler for producing this podcast, and of course to all of you for tuning in. The music is written by Johnny Berliner and I, and performed by Johnny. Our Living Systematic Reviews are supported by funding from Cancer Research UK. The views expressed in this podcast are those of Nicola and I, and do not represent those of the funders.
Switching to vaping is safer than smoking, may help you quit in the end. But remember to mention the findings we have, can't tell us what'll happen long term. Even though we know vaping is safer than smoking, we may still find cause for concern. If you're thinking of switching to vaping, do it! That's what the experts agree. Smoking's so bad for you, they all concur. The vaping beast burning, there's much to learn. Of effects long term yet to be seen. Switch to vaping, do it! That's what the